Hey, it's Dr. Trek, Larry Nemechek, coming at you straight out of Portal 47. And you're listening to the Shuttle Pod. Oh, I see what you did there.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Shuttle Pod. Today is episode number 32 of the Shuttle Pod podcast. I am your host, Kayla Iacovino, and I am joined also by Brian Drew.
Hey, everybody.
And Jared Whitley.
Hello, friends.
And this week, we're going to do another one of our episodes where we take a look back at one of the movies from the Star Trek franchise, and in this case, we have been working up to this one for a while now. It's a look back at Star Trek Nemesis.
Yes, finally.
Exasperated sigh is basically the description of our thoughts about talking about Star Trek Nemesis. Sometimes referred to as the worst Star Trek movie. I think that is part of what we should debate today. Is it the worst? And if not, where does it fall on the worst of Star Trek movies list?
Yeah, that's hard. There's some competition there at the bottom. I think from a story standpoint, Generations is still the worst. But
I'll go with that.
But ouch. If I was flipping stations and I saw Generations on one episode on one channel and Nemesis on another, I would probably stick on Generations now that I, you know, which then maybe it isn't the worst.
I have to say I would stick on Generations 100% of the time if those were the choices.
Yeah.
Because this was what we talked about this in the Generations episode. Like, it's got a lot of problems. It's not a good, well-rounded film, but I still like watching it.
Yeah. Yeah. The problem with Generations is it's stuck between All Good Things and First Contact, and it's obviously not as good as either of those.
Yeah.
The Nemesis, however, is stuck between Insurrection and Oblivion, right? So it's less competitive in its market space, maybe.
True.
Yeah, the tone is completely off in Nemesis. It doesn't fit at all, and it's weird how they try to shoehorn some humor in with, like, odd violence in ways that just don't work, right?
Like, what are you thinking of specifically?
Oh, well, didn't you mentioned something to me about how, like, Data dies and they have, like, this sad funeral with him, and then they lead into, like, some cheerful music right afterwards?
Yeah, and I think, I definitely want to talk about this more, too, when we get to talk, because I think we're going to probably dedicate a good chunk of time talking about Data's death. But that part, I think Act 3 is, in my opinion, the strongest part of the film, which is sort of a low bar, but still, there were a couple of good moments. There were a couple of good moments in the third act that were like, that was a neat moment. But you had just spent an hour and a half watching a terrible film, so you're kind of pissed off by that point. And then they kill Data, which is sad. And I think, like, the moment when they're all on the bridge looking out is, like, a really touching moment. And you feel that. And you feel that when they're standing, you know, in the ready room talking about Data. And it's this, like, sad, very visceral moment. Like, he was a fan. Data's his fan favorite. So we're watching him die. We know he's not coming back from this. And then they cut. And it's like that moment. There was no, like, time to let that moment happen. They just cut to a scene of the Enterprise in dry dock getting rebuilt to the tune of this whimsical take on the TNG theme music. And it's like, it seems disrespectful. Because they go from this, like, impromptu wake to this whimsical da 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 da, and it's like, what? Wait, we're still mourning.
It's an homage to that scene from the motion picture when Kirk is seeing the Enterprise for the first time. That's
interesting.
The music.
Interesting.
Yeah. That's the and it's like, that's not the tone that you want in that moment.
There's also a deleted scene where, like, Picard meets, and you can find it on YouTube, where Picard meets the new first officer, and, like, Worf and Geordi pull this, like, trick on him to haze him. Like, it's probably something about, don't let the tell the captain you're never going to let him lead away missions. Ha, ha, ha.
No, like Riker tells him that.
Oh, Riker tells him that. Yeah, and it's like, that's completely out of place. Anyway, we're kind of laying into this. So after we finished our Insurrection movie, I did a little bit of research, and I kind of wanted to talk about how the world changed to sort of set the stage for us between when that aired in 1998 and when this dropped in 2002. So is it okay if I kind of frame our conversation with this?
Yeah, that sounds great.
This is actually what I'm more interested in talking about than the movie itself. Okay, so something that I looked at when I was doing when we did our podcast about like the different ages of Trek, where we went through kind of decade by decade and like the Platinum Age or the Latinum Age, the Transparent Aluminum Age. If you look at Star Trek by calendar decades, in the 1990s, there's more canonical hours of Star Trek than the other four decades of its existence combined, right?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. And so toward the end when Insurrection came out, this is when Star Trek was at its absolute height. But if we look at the 4 years that happened in between these two movies, Deep Space Nine had gone off the air, Voyager had gone off the air. Both, I think, had lower ratings when they went off than when they started, mm-hmm. or certainly lower ratings than they'd had at their peaks. Enterprise was underperforming. And Trek's influence on sort of the larger sci-fi community was waning. The Babylon 5, which had been like a copycat, was off the air. And Farscape, which was like a deconstructionist Star Trek, was in its last season. In terms of sci-fi, the thing that people were more excited about at that point was The Matrix. And then and stuff that was kind of more Star Trek-y, Firefly had come out. It was the fall of 2002. And Battlestar Galactica would air a year later. But then if you look at non-Star Trek fandom, it was exploding from that four-year period. From 1998 to 2002, we see the first Star Wars prequel, the first Lord of the Rings movie, the first Harry Potter movie, the second Star Wars prequel, the second Lord of the Rings movie, the second Harry Potter, and the first Spider-Man movie. Right?
Wait, in that 4 years?
Yes. Well, technically the second Lord of the Rings movie came out like 2 weeks after Nemesis. Or maybe it was just 1 week.
Still, that's a lot of competition against Nemesis.
I would argue this was when the modern fandom experience was born, particularly with Harry Potter. I mean, we don't realize how valuable the 1-2 punch of Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter was for making geek culture mainstream. But this is when the modern fandom experience was born, and Star Trek was not a part of it. So, very different world. Then there are a couple other things that I realized. It's directly in between these two. And in 4 years, that's longer than any gap there'd been between Star Trek movies. It'd always been 2 or 3 years. So 4 years is already getting to the stage a little late. And I think one movie might be guilty of that, and that would be the first X-Men movie, which came out in 2000. Right? And I think why this perfectly symbolizes Star Trek waning and the rest of geek culture waxing is, of course, because they took our captain to be the star of that movie, or at least the co-star after Hugh Jackman.
Mm-hmm.
Then the other thing, and of course, we're recording this on March 6th, so Logan is coming out. Something, a very sad thing I read the other day is, which I guess I knew but hadn't realized, Patrick Stewart has been in more X-Men movies than he was in Star Trek movies.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense, but he's still been in more Star Trek episodes or hours of Star Trek.
Oh, no question. So, no question. You couldn't.
So we still have him there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And to the public at large, he's still Jean-Luc Picard. Of course. He's not Charles Xavier.
Yeah. And in fact, if you watch the Red Letter Media review of Logan, the guy keeps calling him Picard. Like, to the point where he stops correcting himself. And every time he accidentally says Picard, they flash a picture of him from 1988 up on the screen. Anyway, okay, then there's one other movie, which I think this is actually the most important one to mention of all, that came out just a few months after Insurrection. And I think this did a lot to I guess you'd say it did to the Star Trek franchise what Austin Powers did to James Bond. Do you remember what movie
Galaxy
that would be?
Galaxy Quest?
Yeah. And if you had to choose to watch Nemesis or to watch your DVD of Galaxy Quest, that is not a hard decision to make.
No, it's not. Galaxy Quest is one of the finest films ever made.
I would actually say it's my favorite Star Trek movie.
A lot of people feel that way.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic movie.
It's beautiful. And it's short, too. It's like 100 minutes long, but there's no waste in that film at all.
Mm-hmm.
Nope.
Anyway, but hopefully someday we talk about Galaxy Quest. Maybe that's what we talk about next.
We really should.
We totally should. Yeah. We totally should.
We also, the mission log guys told me once that they were going to talk about it, so we need to be sure to get to it before they do. Anyway.
Ha.
All right.
Okay, so this is the world that we were in 2002 when this came out.
Mm-hmm.
So it would have been a great time for Star Trek to hit a home run. And I don't know enough about baseball, but whatever the opposite worst thing is compared to a home run is what happened.
I think it's just not scoring, I guess.
Yeah, striking.
Grounding into a triple play with the bases loaded.
There we go. Oh, thank you, Brian.
You're welcome.
Okay, me and Jared are over here like, they didn't get any points?
Yeah. I know, Brian, your knowledge of sports and cool things like that threatens your Star Trek cred. No, just kidding. Just kidding. All right, Kayla, now you just finished watching it.
Uh-huh. Literally minutes ago.
Just minutes ago. Okay, now I have not seen it since 2002. I tried to rewatch it on Netflix, but I couldn't make it past the wedding scene. So
one of my favorite things about this episode that we're recording is the fact that you, Jared, were actually physically unable to watch the film.
I tried, man. I couldn't do it.
I tried. Listen, I watched about 40 minutes of it last night, and I couldn't take it.
Oh, really?
I turned it off.
So, yeah. It's this movie has an attrition rate of 2 out of 3 Star Trek fans.
it was worse than I remembered it, and I haven't probably watched it in 5 or 6 years, and it was worse than I remembered.
Yeah, you know what? A big problem this movie has, it's boring. It's so boring.
Even the action scenes are boring.
I'm so uninterested in any of the events of the film until, like I said, you get to the third act. There was a couple of neat moments, but the first 2/3 of the film, like, I couldn't care less. And the whole thing, like, they have all these, you know, various plots that they sort of try to interweave, like a typical movie does, but they somehow fail in Nemesis. And it's like, none of it ever feels believable. Like, the whole thing about how at the very beginning of the film, they pick up the positronic signature. Turns out to be B4. They put him together. Later, we discover that, I guess, the Riemanns put him on some random planet in multiple pieces for some reason. Yeah. And then they had this plan to have the Enterprise happen to find him, pick him up, assemble him. Then to the point where he'd be working, because I don't know how they knew that the Enterprise would find him, that the Enterprise would find all the pieces, that the Enterprise would put him back together again, that they would turn him on so that he could go steal the information and then beam back to the Scimitar. Yeah. That makes no sense.
It's also never explained how the Riemanns got their hands on a super rare Sung-type android.
Yeah, that's never explained. It's never explained why when Picard and crew find the pieces of B4, a bunch of, I don't even think they're Riemanns, random aliens in dune buggies come shooting at them. And we never see from them. We never hear from them again.
Yeah.
So it's just, that whole thing makes no sense.
The whole thing on the planet, everything about what happened on the planet is awful.
And the only reason, I believe, the only reason that whole scene exists, that whole scene of events exists, is because Picard wanted to drive a dune buggy. Well, Patrick Stewart wanted to drive a dune buggy.
Right. Jean-Luc Picard, rugged outdoorsman.
I think Patrick Stewart was like, you have to put in my contract that I get to drive a dune buggy, otherwise I'm not doing this movie.
Okay, I think that's definitely a contributing factor, but the other thing is it was product placement. Because
For the dune buggy?
Yeah, and there is a dune buggy. I'm looking at the website right now. There is a dune buggy called an Argo.
And does it look like the one in the film?
No, it looks like, you know, like a 21st century Earth vehicle, but it's a dune buggy. They Star Trek'd it out, but it as far as Star Trek product placement goes, I will take Kelvin Universe Kirk getting a call on a Nokia phone over the Argo every day of the week.
I guess I would, except for the fact that the Nokia thing is just so blatant. Like, you can't forget.
Yeah.
I didn't realize this was product placement, if it even is, for sure. But, like, the Nokia thing is for sure product placement, and it's obnoxious.
Yeah.
And it's like, guess what? It's actually 2009. It's not really the future. That's how I felt when that, and like when they mentioned Budweiser or whatever it was. Ugh. Anyway, that's a different movie.
Yeah, that's a whole, oh boy, we can go off on that.
Oh, I'm sure we will. Someday. But yeah, no, I do think this is, I do think it was product placement too. And it's, well, it's just egregious. There's no, there's nothing redeeming about that.
And this, the set, the scene, the place they went to film this thing was obviously Southern California with a really awful filter over the lens.
Yeah. Awful filter.
Like everything's blown out.
Yeah. Oh, I want to go talk a little bit about the complete lack of any kind of like creativity in the production design of this movie.
Yeah.
Like that sequence is like, it's a perfect example of it. There's like, it's completely uninspired. There's nothing to that sequence that is original and compelling. Nothing.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, and even like, they don't, like, this is supposed to be a major studio motion picture, and like, you never really get a strong sense of scale about anything. Like, for instance, Riker and Troy got married in Alaska, but you don't know that in the movie.
No. Nope.
You had to have like either read the script or read the novel to know that. Oh. Because they yeah, see, exactly, you didn't know that,
I
did you?
I never knew that. It makes sense. Because Riker is from Alaska, awful, right?
Yeah, they had that awful, tacky backdrop behind them, and that was supposed to be symbolizing that they were in Alaska. Nobody, you know, God, send a second unit crew up to Alaska and shoot some glacier or something. Anything, yeah. Like, to like give us a sense of place. They couldn't even be bothered doing that. Yeah. The movie, that's part of the movie's problem. The movie's cheap.
Yep.
It looks cheap.
Yeah.
And like, it just, the movie looks very, it looks like one of those movies that everybody had to make. They only had a certain amount of money to do it, and they and just kind of went through the motions.
There's no joy in it at all.
No, it's a lifeless, flat movie. Like, nobody seems to be enjoying themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, some of the cast are, like, barely out of shape. Like, Frakes and Dorn, like, were way out of shape.
Dorn looks terrible. And in fact, I remember when we were in Vegas last year, I saw Michael Dorn talking to somebody outside the convention. Also, we were pretty close to him. And he looks amazing
now.
He's
in great shape.
He's terrific. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He's a vegetarian now, isn't he?
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Well, so. Whatever he's
or
doing,
vegan,
it's working.
Or whatever. I forget. He's one of those. Yeah, he looks phenomenal. He looks better than men half his age.
Yeah.
But it's just like this movie that it just, you know, it's hard to get the audience to have a good time if nobody involved in it is having a good time.
Yeah.
You know, so it just, I mean, this movie starts to suck the moment after the main title ends.
Yes, it does. And I will say, I do like that they have the E's facing each other, right? Like the E's are like,
yeah,
in
I like
a mirror.
That too.
I thought that was
that might be
kind
the best
of
part
clever.
Of the whole movie.
Okay,
right? I agree.
Can we talk about that for a minute? Because
please,
sure.
I think there's something really important that this movie gets wrong, and it's its own theme. So it's the theme is Nemesis. Obviously, it's in the name. So the E's are facing each other. It's about Picard meets this guy who's his clone. There's a bunch of lines that Shinzon says. You know, he's like a mirror for Picard. Picard's looking right in a mirror, and so it's like
face.
Yeah,
is it duality?
He even quotes a line from the Bible where the line is, "We see ourselves through a glass darkly." And mm-hmm. Glass darkly is like Elizabethan English way of saying through a dark mirror, right? And so he's even straining to inject some sort of significance into this, mm-hmm. and so that's what they're trying to do. So
yeah,
there's
a very obvious parallel though there between Shinzon and Picard and B4 and Data, and so Data and right. Picard have what I think is a defining moment in terms of the theme of the film when they're in, I guess it's like an astrometrics type room, and they're talking.
I think that's stellar cartography.
Or stellar cartography, yeah. Sure. So they're in the stellar cartography room, and they're talking, and you know, Picard's sort of, you know, apprehensive about this whole thing, and Data basically says, you know, Shinzon isn't a mirror for you. That's not true. He's, you know, and then he uses B4 as a parallel. He says, like, B4 is not me, and I am not B4, and will never be the same, because, you know, B4 doesn't strive to be better than he is, and I do, and Shinzon doesn't strive to be better than he is, and you do. So there's this whole theme throughout the movie where, and even there's a scene earlier where Geordi and Data are talking, and Geordi is, like, uncomfortable with Data giving his memory engrams to B4. And he's saying, you know, maybe B4 shouldn't be more like you. Maybe he's supposed to be just like he is. And Data is just basically like, you know, he's, well, but he's not me. And I think I want to give him the chance to see if he can be a better, you know, a better creature. So anyway, there's this theme throughout the movie about this duality and this mirror thing, but it seems like the characters come to the conclusion that that the mirror isn't real. And like I felt happy with that after Picard and Data had this discussion that no, you know, Shinzon and Picard are not equals, and they're not, you know, it's not just a showing them, you know, showing Picard another side of him or something like that. It's they're totally unique beings, and this is harped on a lot, and there's other examples of this. Okay, now the end of the movie, the very end of the movie, when we see that B4 has sort of taken some of Data's memories, and they're starting to come out in him. And this makes, he sings the Blue Skies song. He hums the Blue Skies song, and then Picard is happy. And there's supposed to be this moment for the audience of, oh, like Data maybe isn't really dead because he's still alive in B4. But I think that totally undermines this whole idea of them being completely separate and unique entities. Because I was happy with the idea that B4 could never be Data, and Data's sure. dead. He's gone now. I don't think he can come back. And so I'm not sure what they want me to think B4 means or B4 is at the end of the film. I feel like they want me to think there's hope, but...
I think what it was a lazy trapdoor. If they said, well, if this does well and we need to do a fifth movie, mm-hmm. we still want Brent to come back. It was just sloppy, sort of Dick Tracy-esque serialization.
Yeah, I think it's very sloppy. I think it has no place in the film.
Yeah, and it also goes back to the fact that it's probably an homage to some degree. I mean, I know you think that the third act is the strongest part of the movie. I think it's actually it's probably the worst part of the movie for me, because the third act is basically a reprisal of The Wrath of Khan.
Yeah.
With the search for Spock thrown in at the end. I mean, that Thaleron radiation thing is basically the Genesis device being armed.
Yeah, yep. You're right. You're right.
Data goes over, basically knocks out Picard, gets him off the ship, and like Spock nerve pinched McCoy, gets blown up, and we all think, oh, poor Data's gone. No, not so fast. His Katra is in B4.
His living spirit.
Yeah.
His living spirit. So, like, I mean, I remember being in the theater going, oh, come on, you've got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
But it doesn't work. Like, this, as we all know, this is not the first time someone will try to redo that part but it doesn't work, because the reason Wrath of Khan worked is because it was like part of this intricate fabric of the story that was being told, and it made sense in that story. It's not this piece that you can unplug and plug in somewhere else.
Yeah, there's also, I mean, the so much of the theme of Wrath of Khan is that Kirk regrets that he does not have a family, right? And then he mm-hmm. realizes mm-hmm. he does, right?
Right. Yeah, I felt like this thing with this talk thing that they did at the end of Nemesis is just had no place in the film. I think there were some moments in the third act, and I'm considering the third act basically from the space battle to the end.
Yeah, I'll say I remember when to touch on what I said before. I think even that space battle is boring. I mean, like, you can tell they got these cool ships and they're shooting each other, and they fire so many photon torpedoes that, like, they run out, which I didn't think they could do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, the armament of 2,000 torpedoes or whatever.
Yeah, you don't ever see them fire, like, a dozen or two.
Yeah, yeah, which, again, goes to the cheapness. Although I will say, in terms of the production design, I thought the Romulan ships looked kind of cool, and I did appreciate that they made new ships rather than just reusing stuff from the series.
The scimitar looked
cool.
It did
look really cool.
Yeah.
Interior-wise, though, like, they spent, like, no money. They just made everything really dark.
Did anyone else notice that the doors in the scimitar are the doors from the Enterprise? Like, they're like the cargo bay doors, like the holodeck doors?
Oh, good heavens.
Are they really?
Yeah. The same shape.
Ugh. Ugh.
Yeah.
See, even Herman Zimmerman was bored.
And the whole thing where they get Picard and Data get in the little scorpion shuttle inside the scimitar, and then they like fly through the hallways.
That was so stupid.
Totally stupid. Yeah. And also, like, this, like, sometimes I can forgive things like this, but it was too much of a stretch for me, like, size wise. There's no way that ship would have fit inside those hallways based on the hallways we had just seen. Because they're about the same size as the Enterprise hallways. You couldn't fit a shuttle in there.
Yeah, you're right. There's also kind of this stupid scene, and I can't remember if they brought it back in the movie or it was just in the trailer, which is usually a sign of bad editing when there's a lot, when there's stuff in the trailer that isn't in the movie, mm-hmm. where Data's like, oh, I recommend against this, Captain. It's very dangerous. And he says, I don't know, Data. Let's find out. And it's like, when did Picard become a teenager trying to show off, right? What happened to our rational, clear-thinking hero?
Yeah. Yeah. That might have been, was that in the Argo scene?
No, I think it's when they're
It's in the Scorpion scene. You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, it was stupid.
Oh. Yeah, I remember there's another line in the trailer where Worf says, I recommend extreme caution. And I'm like, that's your trailer bait? Is saying extreme caution? There's nothing better than that? This was the first Star Trek movie where I saw the trailer online, right? And I remember just not caring.
Yeah.
It was so bad.
Yeah, I felt the same way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I went opening weekend out of habit more than anything.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. Yeah, I remember the girl I was dating at the time, we went to see this, and we bumped into a neighbor of hers on the way out, and she and I just both thought it was awful. And the guy says, her neighbor says, well, that was good, but what's their next adventure going to be? And we look at him and say, buddy, this is the end of the line, right? There's no more adventures after this.
Oh, yeah, I thought it was dead when I walked out. I mean, there was no way.
There's also, like, the opening shot with the Romulan Senate where I feel like they're trying to channel the spirit of the Phantom Menace with the whole Galactic Senate stuff. And I'm like, you took the dumbest part of the dumbest Star Wars movie and that's what you decided to ape?
That's how what could they you open with.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. You really think they were aping Star Wars?
I think they were.
It's certainly, they were. If they weren't, it's certainly reminiscent of it. I have to admit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I will say it's reminiscent.
And, I mean, they even have some filler lines of like when they're, first of all, I love when the Romulan lady with the death device is like leaves this thing on the table and is like, gets up and is all like, excuse me, I have a meeting in the other room. Goodbye. Yeah. And like walks out and everyone's like, cool, that was weird. Okay, so on to our next thing.
Yeah, nobody notices that she leaves like this big red device on the table.
Right?
Yeah.
And that it was like super awkward when she left.
And you would think it would be like, oh, excuse me, you left this behind. You might, you know.
Right?
Yeah.
You left this glowing that's what most people death, would do. Death device. Yeah.
It's also been established that the Romulan Tal Shiar, their intelligence service, is like the most efficient, ruthless organization in the galaxy. And like they're the reason that, you know, Romulan dictatorship is able to endure. Because, you know, like a Romulan family cannot sit down to dinner without the Tal Shiar noting what they eat, right? And yet somehow in their most secure building ever, she's able to just lazily sneak an explosive in.
With Thaleron radiation, which apparently is quite traceable because Geordi was able to find it. It's like has a unique spectral signature.
Ah, yeah. Well, I didn't catch that connection. That's another inconsistency. Okay, so I do need to mention something. There was this Star Trek customizable card game in the 90s and the early 2000s where they were trying to copy like Magic the Gathering. And for the Nemesis expansion, they have like, you know, cards of the different crew that you can buy and play and whatever. And for the Beverly card, Beverly had so little to do that the only quote they could get from the movie to put on her card is, I can't begin to tell you how dangerous Thaleron radiation is. And I'm like, that's it? That's all you gave this wonderful lady who's given 14 years of her life to your franchise? Ah, it's something they should have had the computer say.
Ouch. Yeah, I didn't even realize how underused Beverly was because I was so focused on how crap the rest of the movie was.
Okay, do we want to? Oh, sorry, Brian, you had something.
Now, I'd like to circle back to the Romulan Senate for a minute,
mm-hmm. please.
That's when you kind of know at the very beginning of the movie that the movie's in trouble, though, because like they go out of the main credits and you go toward Romulus and you go through the clouds and you go to like this horrendous CG representation, of the Capitol where it's like, would you guys render this on a PS2?
Yeah. For 7 years, we had these beautiful matte paintings.
Yeah, it was this awful thing. And then you get into this council chamber that is no bigger than some of the student council rooms I was in college. It's like, this is where the Romulan Senate convenes in this shitty little room.
And there's like six of them.
It's budget cuts after the Dominion War.
They couldn't even CGI some extra senators.
It's like come on.
Yeah.
My God. I mean, I know Star Trek is kind of stuck in its TV roots, but come on, guys.
Okay, no, but at the time, I mean, the last few seasons of Voyager and Deep Space Nine are incredible. The special effects that they're able to do for some of the space battles.
Yes, absolutely.
And stuff. Especially like absolutely. When I was rewatching the last episode of last season of Voyager a few years ago, they do some beautiful stuff. And so there's absolutely no excuse for this.
Hmm.
No.
And even
there's total lack of imagination in the movie. Mm-hmm. It's amazing.
I rewatched Broken Bow, the pilot to Enterprise, I think I told you, Brian. And even the production mm-hmm. values on that are great.
Mm. Yes, I like Broken Bow.
Yeah, it's good.
We talked about this. It's one of the better Star Trek pilots.
I think it's the. I will say this for later, but I think it's the best Star Trek pilot.
It might be. Yeah, yeah. I'll go with that. Okay. That, the DS9 pilots are my two favorite.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, let's see. We're talking about endings, not beginnings. So in terms of endings, are there any other aspects of sending the crew off that we want to talk about? Do you want to talk about the wedding, or do we want to talk about Wesley's cameo?
The wedding sucked.
It did.
Yeah, the wedding sucks. Lame.
It also doesn't make any sense why they would get back together after years of nobody caring about their relationship and then wait 4 years to get married.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, am I the only one who just didn't care about Riker and Troy shipping?
No, you're not the only one.
Okay.
No, but it was just kind of, yeah, but I think we've discussed this in the past about the whole concept behind Riker and Deanna's relationship. Got to be kind of silly after a while during the series.
Yeah.
Because once it was pretty much established that Riker was not leaving the Enterprise anytime soon, the fact that they didn't resume their relationship was always kind of odd to me.
Yeah, after like Best of Both Worlds, they should have gotten back together if they were going to.
Yeah, I just thought it was very odd that they would get involved with other people, mm-hmm. But they would still be affectionate with one another. And like,
and still just, call each other Zadi.
Yeah, it was very weird thing. So when they finally hooked up again in Insurrection, I was like, oh good, finally get him out of the way already.
Yeah, and at least some of the stuff in Insurrection was cute, like when she's shaving him in the bath, like that's uh-huh. a cute little scene.
And it makes sense that they would get back together in Insurrection because they're all feeling like young and rejuvenated again.
Yep, and her boobs were firming up.
Her I was just gonna say
that. Of course, not that we care about such things.
No, of course not. Okay, so now one thing that I want to touch on, and maybe I've mentioned this before. So there's kind of a problem I feel with most of the Next Generation movie phenomenon, where I feel like they're operating off of the season one Bible rather than how the characters evolved and progressed over the 7 years. For example, like when they're at the wedding and Picard makes the joke about, you know, when you're going to become a captain, don't let your first officer push you around when you want to go on an away mission. Because, like, that was something they'd done in the first couple of years, but mm-hmm. then not really mm-hmm. later on. I mean, Picard went on away missions whenever it was really important. It wasn't mm-hmm. So much that Riker wouldn't let Picard go on the most dangerous missions. It was Picard would let Riker lead the less interesting missions is mm-hmm. how it sort of evolved.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, and like, you know, throughout this, you know, and Brent Spiner aged the character, matured the character so well in terms of the way he talks and the tone he uses and little things he does with his body. Like there's one episode I remember where Data is like lurching over a kind of adventurously over a chair the way he's seen Riker do, with just like one leg up on it because he's trying to experiment with what his human friends are teaching him. And then mm-hmm. I feel like in Nemesis they go back and then of course the moment that hangs a lantern on it so well is All Good Things, where we see the contrast of Data in the three time zones, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is great performance by Brent. And then with Nemesis, I feel like they go back to the first season, right? Whether it's caring about the Riker-Troy shipping that was more important in the early years or some of this other stuff that I've mentioned. And it's just disappointing. Because, of course, going out of season 7, the thing that we wanted to see in the movies in terms of shipping was Beverly and Picard, right?
Mm-hmm.
With Attached, which is a great episode. Yay. And then with them getting married and divorced in All Good Things.
Right.
Yeah, totally. I would have loved to have seen that. And I think it's interesting you bring that up about them going back to an earlier evolution of the characters, because also in that in the wedding scene where Picard's making jokes about the away mission thing, and then Data does the, oh, yes, it is the, you know, whatever, chapter 4, section 32.
Oh, yeah, and he tells him to shut up, right?
Yeah, but that's also the same, you know, Data being annoying because he just keeps talking about, you know, regulations or quoting numbers or something, and he has to be shut up. And that's an old trope.
Very old. Yeah, and like him not getting that this is not the appropriate situation to be quoting chapter and verse of the Starfleet Manual.
Right, like he figured that he would know that.
Yeah, I forgot about that. Wow. Yeah. Okay, then the other thing is Wesley at the end of TNG went off to explore the universe and higher levels of existence with the Traveler, and at the end of Deep Space Nine, Worf became the Federation ambassador to Kronos, and they just throw them both in there, and there's no explanation at all for what happened to these characters.
Right. Although, yeah, Wesley's in there in a blink and you miss it kind of a way.
Okay,
like, you know, you could easily miss him in that master shot if you're not paying attention.
See, and you mentioned that I was reading on Memory Alpha that. And of course, everything we watch is widescreen now. But in the clipped version, where it's just a square instead of
full
a rectangle,
screen,
I can't remember.
Yeah.
Full screen.
The pan and scan.
Yeah, that you can't even see Wesley.
I think he had scenes that were cut. Isn't that right?
He did.
Yeah.
He did.
But I think even those scenes don't explain why he's not
why he's
trying
there.
To... Yeah. Why after...
Yeah, and
after,
what is why yeah. is Worf like a member of the crew again? Is that
because it was in Michael Dorn's contract?
Yeah,
but there is. Am I missing an explanation, or there really isn't one for why he's like?
There isn't one at all.
There is not one. And it's just back on the
at least in First Contact. In First Contact, they make an excuse for him coming back.
Yeah,
by,
and then
they barely try an insurrection.
Well, they make a joke about it, which I think I actually like. I like that they're so tongue in cheek about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like they don't even bother giving you the full explanation. You kind of just hear the voice, his voice, like
trail off. Yeah.
Like he doesn't in the middle of his explanation because nobody really gives a shit.
No,
but
at this point, after you know getting this great promotion, he's a member of the House of Martok. He gets to live on Kronos with all his fellow Klingons. They could have at least said something, or I don't know, at least given him a line about Tholaron radiation.
Hmm.
What were you saying, Kayla? I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. Jared, I wanted to piggyback.
And then Loxana wasn't there. I'm sorry, at the wedding, why wasn't... I mean, did Majel not want to
appear? Well, the wedding was going to be on Betazed, I guess. So she would have
been at that one. Yeah, maybe she was only going to go to the Betazoid wedding, which is naked, by the way. And did we mention that they're going to be naked? And also that they're not going to be wearing clothes?
Yeah, okay, the idea of the Betazoid...
Did we mention that eight times about how there's no clothes?
Oh, good heavens, wow.
And Picard's going to be in the gym if you need him. Yeah.
Yeah, boy.
Yep. That could have been a funny joke if that movie wasn't so terrible. But I wanted to piggyback on your talking about earlier evolutions of the crew members to jump to another point, which is that the fact that Shinzon, Tom Hardy's character, is supposed to basically be young Picard because he's not been super aged. And, okay... You know, I could kind of be okay with the fact that Tom Hardy looks nothing like Patrick Stewart, except for that they shaved his head. I personally think he looks nothing like Patrick Stewart. And they make an excuse for that.
And they give him the nose.
The nose.
Ish. But the ears are wrong. And they're like, they broke. He said, there's a line, he's like, years of violence will do that to you.
Yeah.
They broke my nose and my jaw. Blah, blah, blah. Yeah, blah, blah, blah. But... I wasn't buying that, but anyway. But the thing that gets me is when Picard... It's so stupid. When Picard is back on the Enterprise, like, looking at his old photo album.
Oh, yeah.
He pulls out a picture, and it's Tom Hardy in the old the Academy uniform, like, ding.
Yeah.
And he's... And here's the thing, though. He's bald. Why on earth do the writers think that we will only recognize Picard if he's bald? We know that Picard wasn't bald when he was in the Academy. We've seen it.
Yep.
What the decision was not made for Star Trek fans. It was for the general
public. I know,
public.
But come on. People aren't so stupid that they think a bald man has been bald forever.
Bald
and he looks like a retard.
Life.
He looks like a retard in that picture.
I agree. It was a stupid move. I agree.
There's a flashback in the fifth season episode, Violations, where we see Picard delivering Jack Crusher's body to Beverly, which presumably that's just a couple years before Encounter at Farpoint. And although his hair is thinning, he has hair in that episode.
Mm-hmm. And he has hair.
It's tapestry.
We see he has a full head of hair in that episode.
When he's in the academy. Yeah, that's right. Man, so, even a couple of surly Nausicaans couldn't have saved this movie.
Exactly. I would have liked to have seen
Should we talk about Tom Hardy a little bit?
Yeah, please.
I think he did a great job.
He did the best that he could.
He really did. It was a thankless job trying to do that gig. And mm-hmm. I thought he did. And he was very young at the time. And I thought he really pulled it off. He's not channeling Patrick because, let's face it, he couldn't. Doing that would be a mistake, too. But the performance itself, I thought, was a good one.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I would say it was the best it could have been. All right. I mean,
yes, for what the circumstances, it was the best it could be.
For having a director who didn't care and didn't understand Star Trek, and for having a script that was awful, and for having that terrible costume with the huge shoulder pads.
The shoulder pads.
Yeah.
It looks like a Lady Gaga outfit.
Oh, yeah.
It does.
Yeah. Yeah.
I thought he did a nice job.
He did. Overall. He did. And I was pleasantly surprised to see when Tom Hardy was able to recover from this. Because he is a good actor.
Yes, he is. Very talented.
What has he been in since Nemesis?
He was in Inception. He was in The Dark Knight Rises. Inception, he was in The Revenant. Yeah. He's been in that. I think that was his big return, was Inception, which would have been 8 years later. Maybe he was in some minor stuff in between then.
You just named three fantastic films.
Mm. Well, and films that he's fantastic in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I forgot he was in The Revenant, too.
Yeah.
Yep.
I actually thought he was the best part of The Revenant. I liked his performance a lot better than DiCaprio's.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, so Shinzon. Now, the thing is, substantively, and I remember getting in a gentle debate with my uncle after Nemesis about this, where he said, and he was more of a casual Star Trek fan, he said, I can't understand why people don't like this. I mean, the idea of the Romulans cloning a Starfleet captain so that they can use him as a plant, which, you know, obviously wouldn't show up in any kind of DNA scans, is not the captain. I think that's a clever idea. And it's like, yeah, that is a clever Romulan scheme. I do kind of like that. I also like the idea that it was a scheme that kind of got abandoned, right? Like, with as chaotic and treacherous as Romulans are with each other, it kind of makes sense that not all of their plans would work out beautifully and some stuff would just get discarded. Now, having said that, I don't understand how this guy who just gets discarded somehow manages to be the most amazing mm-hmm. leader in Romulan history. Mm. And again, referring to how incompetent the Tal Shiar have become since Counselor Troi pretended to be one in face of the enemy. I don't understand how they didn't notice the Remans developing this super weapon and the super scimitar. And how the Remans we've been told, are just cannon fodder and at the bottom of the hierarchy.
They're like slaves, basically.
Basically slaves. I don't know how they came up with a perfect cloak when the Romulans themselves couldn't, the Klingons couldn't, the Dominion couldn't, nobody could.
And also just like, where did they get the money to build this giant thing?
Yeah, the resources.
If they're really, all of them are like under the heel of the Romulans and they're like down in the dilithium mines. Also, yeah. Why? I could have lived with this if they'd given some kind of explanation, but whose bright idea was it to be like, oh, Picard clone? And they even say they wanted to hide me because, Shinzon says they wanted to hide me because if I had been found out, it could have started a war. Why don't they just kill him? Why did they put him in the mines?
That made no sense to me either.
Yeah.
Yeah, just kill him.
They don't need another miner.
Yeah.
No.
Makes no sense. It's like none of these things were thought out. Like it's like a draft. It's like they wrote it down and they're like, cool, nothing could possibly be wrong. Let's not go over this again. Let's just film it.
They had 4 years to develop a movie and they went with what seemed like the first draft.
Mm-hmm.
Ugh. Yeah.
Now, do we want to talk about the Remans at all? Because, I mean, the whole idea is Romulans are kind of based on Romans, which is why they do that salute. At least in the original series, mm-hmm. and which is why they use terms like centurion and praetor, and they talk about the Senate. And of course, from Romulan mythology, we have Romulus and Remus, right? And so that had always kind of been there as maybe something, but we'd never heard about Remans before, and we'd certainly never seen them as these weird kind of vampire monsters. So what do we think about the Remans?
I like the idea of the Remans, honestly. I like the idea of a gravitationally locked planet that one side always faces the sun and the other always faces away, and that they have minds on the far side of the planet. Like, that's pretty cool. I don't know why they look like vampires, especially because you would assume that Romulans and Remans would be, like, from the same ancestry, or are they completely different? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I think they have pointed ears. Do the Remans have pointed ears?
Yeah, but I think that's the only thing that's similar. And they're humanoid. They're vaguely humanoid, and they have pointed ears. But they're like, weird, like, lizard vampires.
I do like the idea of a conquered people. Like, we have all these empires in Star Trek, and as far as I can tell, the only time they've ever conquered – any of these empires has ever conquered another race was the Cardassians and the Bajorans. Mm. So I like the idea that, the Romulans conquer people. They're bad.
Uh-huh.
But then yet they're also, like, related to.
Yeah, I don't know what the relation is.
No one has ever explained how Vulcans and Romulans are related. Like, did they come from the same planet and at some point a bunch of them left? Did they? Has that been explained?
They did. It has been explained. It had something to do with when Serac tried to bring logic and reason to the Vulcan people, a certain group of Vulcans did not go along with what he was saying, and they picked up their stuff and left.
They talk about this in Enterprise, don't they?
Is that in All Our Yesterdays? Did they talk about that? I don't know. I think they talk about it in Enterprise.
There's a whole storyline with what's her name? T'Pol in Enterprise, where they have to, like, go to Vulcan and find something, and she's, like, telling Archer the story of Sarek.
All right. Well, I'm sorry. I should do a little more research before I introduce this. It just always seemed like...
That's all right.
Like, at what point did... Because Serac was, like, a pre-warp civilization. And so, like, at what point did the Romulans have the warp capability to go to a whole other planet colonize? Anyway, that's not important. Okay, so the Remans. Then the main Reman, like Shin Zan's lieutenant, is actually played by Ron Perlman, who is actually a great actor. And it's kind of crazy to me that he's wasted in this role.
Yeah. Got a great voice. I love his voice.
Yeah, he does.
Kind of nuts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, he
Yeah, the Viceroy is actually a pretty, like, legit character. I kind of like the character of the Viceroy.
Should they have just made him the bad guy?
They did some random B story with him wrestling with Riker in some offshoot of a Jeffrey's tube. And I laughed out loud they, like, tumble down. They're, like, on this, like, catwalk bridge thing, and then the bridge comes loose, and they tumble down, and it's exactly like Generations at the end of old men wrestling in the desert. But it's Lizard Vampire and Fat Riker wrestling in the Jeffrey's tube.
Yeah. I mean, there is no way Riker would have survived that battle. He would have gotten so winded so quickly.
But them flying down on the bridge, it even looked like they used the same rigging or something, because, like, the way it tumbles is exactly, like, reminiscent of the Kirk.
Yeah, another uninspired moment.
Yeah, totally uninspired. And it was like, what was the point of that whole scene? And then the guy just falls to his death at the end.
Well, I think Riker was also trying to get revenge on the Viceroy.
For what? Oh, for the mind rape?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't get that at all.
I think, maybe.
They should have, that would have made a little bit more sense. They would have had some motivation.
The fact that it's not clear to either one of you goes to show how flawed the whole sequence is.
Oh, yeah. it's as far as I could tell, totally meaningless. And it didn't, I was like looking for meaning in it. I was like, the action in this scene is not paralleling the action in the A storyline. In fact, it's a little bit lagging behind. So, like, there's a resolution in the A storyline. There's like a lull moment, and then it shows Riker fighting again, and they just, like, the dude falls to his death. The end.
Yeah. I think that scene falls into the category of giving someone something to do.
Yep, absolutely.
I mean, I was talking with my brother about The Empire Strikes Back a week or two ago, and the thing is, like, the Luke storyline and the Han storyline are perfect, right? In terms of the symmetry, where Luke is this, you know, destined superhero, he's an extraordinary man in an ordinary world, and Han is an ordinary guy who's caught up in extraordinary events. Right. Mm-hmm. And so one of them is trying to do the simplest thing in the world, which is pay off some debts. And the other is trying to become, you know, this Jedi Knight. And they're beautiful. The way they converge at the end, too, with one of them getting caught up as a pawn for the other. That is not what happened here.
Yeah.
Not sure what happened here.
Yeah.
Do we want to talk? Sorry.
No, no problem. I just want to circle back again to talking about Vulcans. Now, there's a certain Vulcan that is on Romulus during this whole thing.
That,
at least
yeah,
I think he is.
Yeah.
And I don't even think that was ever a consideration.
Wow.
When they decided to make this. I mean, I could be wrong, but I don't recall ever reading any literature of any kind suggesting that they even thought about bringing in Leonard Nimoy.
No. No, thank you for mentioning that. I appreciate you mentioning that. I know that he'd passed on Generations, which is why James Doohan and Walter Koenig were in there. But it would have made perfect sense. Even if they just talked to one of Spock's agents and dropped the phrase cowboy diplomacy, mm-hmm. that would have been something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, even a little thing. Yeah, I mean, Christ, even have him on in the movie for like a few minutes or something. Like, I just, you know, I guess that's just, they probably didn't want to, you know, they weren't interested in using Ian Waller, or they simply didn't want to pay him, and that was it.
Yeah, but that was definitely.
And then there's also Scylla. Too.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. As well as, you know, the Tomalak, in terms of other Romulan adversaries from the series they could have brought back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah. Spock, not seeing Spock when they're on Romulus was kind of like stood out to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an amazing oversight.
Yep.
Or if not oversight, at least Picard
could have said, you know, I hope, you know, we should try to find out the whereabouts, you know, ascertain the whereabouts of Ambassador Spock, or something.
Or he even could have made a joke where he could have said, Romulus has changed since the last time I was here. It's like, what? You've been to Romulus as a way of Picard just reminding people that, you know, I'm an action hero. Or a cowboy diplomat, at least. Or a diplomatic cowboy, however you say it.
So I think we're nearing the end, but there's a couple of things that I think we should touch on briefly, at least.
Okay.
Including the creative team behind this, so the director, mm-hmm. And then also talking a little bit. I see here in the notes, Jared, that you've written some information about the money, which is an interesting story as well.
Yeah, if by interesting you mean sad.
Well, yeah, I think it's another piece to the Nemesis puzzle.
Which is what? Let's hear it.
Oh, it's the worst performing Star Trek ever. $60 million budget, made $43 million domestic, $24 million international. So a budget of $60 million, it cleared $67 million, that's a loss right there.
Yeah, easily.
Yeah, and then even if you adjust,
it came in second. Opening weekend.
Yeah. Oh, it's the only Star Trek
made
ever
in
do
Manhattan.
That. Made in Manhattan. That's right.
Wait. Made in Manhattan.
Yeah, it's
first.
Like a Richard Gere, Jennifer Lopez.
I know exactly what movie that is.
Hey,
Ralph Fiennes.
Made
I think.
In
oh,
Manhattan.
Oh, it's Ralph Fiennes. Okay. Yeah.
That's like a joke in and of itself.
Yeah.
Yep. It couldn't beat Made in Manhattan.
Yeah.
And then the following weekend, it dropped off like nearly 80%, which up until that point was the biggest drop off, second week drop off in the history of motion pictures.
Wow. That's saying something.
Yeah.
But guys, Made in Manhattan.
I know.
The title,
well, that's what I knew. I mean, when I saw, when I
is even a pun, by the way, for those who are listening, it's MAID in Manhattan because it's about a maid. Like, that's the movie that beat Nemesis.
Yep.
Okay. Anyway, moving on. That blew my mind.
Yeah.
Okay. I also want to say it's got the second lowest Rotten Tomatoes score at 37%. Final Frontier is at 23%. I stridently disagree with that. I and we'll talk about this eventually. But I actually like the Final Frontier. I actually think there's a lot of good parts in it. But Nemesis is unredeemable.
It at least has some charming moments in it.
Yes. And at least the director really cared about it, right?
Yeah.
The director wasn't completely. Okay, so mentioning the director, so Stuart Baird, he had no connection to the franchise. Now, something that I read at one point is he got the directing gig in a deal with Paramount. Like, they wanted him to edit Tomb Raider, the Angelina Jolie vehicle. And he said, okay, I'll edit that, but only if you give me a directing gig. And so they gave him this. And I think...
Yeah. And he had directed other movies.
Oh, had he?
This wasn't his first.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. This is his third or fourth feature.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
But yes... His stock in trade was as a very, 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 very good film editor.
Mm.
He edited Superman the movie, all the Lethal Weapons.
Oh, wow.
I mean, he worked. Yeah, he worked with Richard Donner quite a bit. Wow. He's a very, very gifted. In fact, to this day, like when movies are in trouble, they bring him in to fix them.
Oh, interesting. Wow.
He's a very talented guy. He just, you know, he was clearly not the right fit.
Yeah, for Star Trek. Just had no idea what he was doing. I mean, I remember seeing something where like he thought LeVar Burton's name was LeVon, and like he couldn't get his name right.
Oh,
and I'm like,
ouch.
He's the most famous guy on the show. He was on Roots and Reading Rainbow. How can you not know his name?
And just the fact that you're supposed to be a leader to the cast.
Wow.
You should know their freaking names.
Although there's a certain... There are two different versions of how he was in the set. Like, LeVar didn't like him, obviously, for understandable reasons. If the guy can't figure out your name, it's pretty awful. I wouldn't like him either. But I think Marina didn't like him. But Patrick did. And so did Frakes. And so did Brent Spiner.
Oh.
So...
Well, then Brent Spiner, I think he's also buddies with John Logan, who wrote it, right?
That's right. That's right.
And Brent Spiner and Rick Berman are credited with the story by.
Mm-hmm.
And John Logan...
So it's partially Brent's fault, this movie.
Yeah, no question.
Yeah.
And the thing is, like, John Logan, like, I think he'd got... I mean, he wrote Gladiator a couple years before this, which won Best Picture.
Yeah.
And he,
I know, he's a very talented... Yeah.
He also wrote Skyfall, which was one of the best James Bond movies ever.
The Aviator...
Oh, wow.
The Scorsese movie.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, no, he's written a lot of different things over the years. A few Broadway shows, I think. I
guess he was, like, on drugs when he wrote this one.
Or not on enough.
I don't know what.
He needed to take some performance-enhancing drugs.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, or they kind of just let him write whatever he wanted, and nobody had the nerve to tell him, hey, man, this isn't very good.
Yeah, it could be.
You know?
I guess.
Clearly it didn't work. It didn't work.
So, I know we're running out of time. Is there anything they could have done better? Is there anything substantive that they could have done better, or would you just have to start from scratch?
I think you have to start from scratch.
I think so too. Yeah.
I don't think there's much. There's not a whole lot of redeeming things to this.
No.
And it's very sad too, because you know that this cast deserved a nice bon voyage.
Yeah, there ain't nobody signing their signature at the end of this movie while the music plays triumphantly. And
my God, Peter the difference Pan. Between the, the difference between this and the Undiscovered Country is like,
that's
how you send somebody off.
It's
the Undiscovered Country.
It's as significant as the differences between the side of Remus that faces the sun and the side that doesn't.
Good one.
Yeah, very disappointing. Yeah. It was very disappointing to see that this was the way it was going to end. It was just like almost like a whimper.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know?
I love how they write in the thing with B4, like, hey, just in case there's going to be another one. It's like, ha, no.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, like what?
Oh,
yeah,
that was totally planted. That's totally designed to be like the little plant in case they decided to come back completely. Totally.
And it's like they were delusional enough to think there would be another one after this.
Yeah. Now, why didn't Jonathan Frakes direct this? Because he'd done, I mean, First Contact was great, and Insurrection, the problems with that were not the director. Why did he not want to do it?
I think the studio or Rick Berman or somebody wanted to try somebody else.
Wow. It's too bad because Frakes is a great director.
And he
loves it. They should have just let Jonathan do it.
Yeah. That's what I need. If I ever next convention, I need to go out of my way to try to ask him a question and ask him what he thought about that.
Yeah, it's a good question.
At this point, he probably also, there's no reason for him to be politic and he could say whatever he wants.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. So we're coming to a close, I think, on this episode of the Shuttle Pod. Before we go, I'd like to know, worst Star Trek movie ever?
Yeah.
Because
I could sit through all the other Star Trek movies. I can't sit through this one.
Yeah. Yeah. It probably is. In terms of production design is bad, the tone is bad. It utterly fails to accomplish what it's seeking out to do.
Uh-huh.
And even though I think from a story perspective it is better than Generations, this probably is the worst.
I don't even know that it's better story. I don't know, maybe. I don't know that it's better story wise. I think it's the worst film. Definitely the worst TNG film, and I think it's also the worst film overall. Because, like I said earlier, you know, Generations has a lot of problems, but I still really enjoy watching that film. It brings me joy to sit down and watch Star Trek Generations. Nemesis, not so much.
You can also tell that William Shatner and Patrick Stewart are having fun, even if the idea of bringing the two captains together wasn't executed particularly well, it's still fun to see them.
Yeah, the thing with the horse.
And they had good chemistry. And they had good chemistry
great,
together.
Great chemistry.
But yeah, the movie overall is it's kind of stupid, but it's fun to watch.
And at the end of the day, that's all that really matters, right?
Yep. Yeah. Oh, the other thing, it doesn't make any sense that Shinzon would want to annihilate Earth when the people who've mistreated him have been the Romulans.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't make any sense at all.
None of it makes any sense.
No.
It's just everything is crap.
This is a movie that would be good to do an audio commentary on if we could survive the 2 hours it would take to do it.
I think that's the only way
There'd have to be a lot of drinking, I think.
Yeah, a lot of alcohol involved, definitely.
Romulan ale, may I suggest.
And then there's this horribly executed joke moment at the beginning at the wedding when Rorf is like hungover and he says, Romulan ale should be illegal. And then Jordan looks at him and goes, It is.
Okay, right. I'm going to point out again that pursuant to the treaty that united the Federation, the Klingon Empire, and the Romulan Empire to fight oppose the Dominion, Romulan ale became legal in the Federation after that. Yeah, they mention it in an episode of Deep Space Nine.
Come on, guys. Yeah. Get it together, Nemesis.
Yeah, and I realize this was pre-Memory Alpha, but that episode was like 2 years old at that point. Come on.
Get it together. Come on.
Wow. Wow.
And on that note, I think that about does it for episode number 32 of the Shuttle Pod, a.k.a. Revisiting Nemesis, a.k.a. Nemesis is the worst movie of all time.
Yeah.
Terrible.